everybody around the country, I think, has a heavy heart and is thinking a lot about what the terrorist attacks mean, not only for your community, but for the rest of us on a whole number of different levels. But it's been a heartbreaking and profoundly challenging event, I think, for us all to deal with. I want to thank the chat club, whose deliberations I've kind of been blog posts and things I've been following with a lot of interest over the last few months. And I really appreciate the effort that's gone to trying to stimulate and inform a really valuable debate in Canterbury about the future shape of your city and your communities, and how the community and local government and central government can work together to tackle some of these the big challenges around housing and transport and urban growth. I want to just start really by laying out some of the key themes of government policy that I think provide what I hope will be a helpful sort of terrain upon which you can have the sort of the debates that that this evening's about. The first is that it recognised that in New Zealand that our cities have been failing. For a highly urbanised country, we're not very good at managing the growth of our cities, integrating transport and housing policy, and investing in the infrastructure that's needed. And these are some of the big challenges that we have. We must urgently, in our larger cities, reduce car dependency. That is one of the big challenges. Why? Because cities that are as car dependent as is the norm in New Zealand are condemned to perpetual congestion on the road. And the reason is that when we have underdeveloped and underinvested public transport systems, as is normal in New Zealand, and very low mode share for public transport, the inevitable response to congestion on the roads is to build more roading capacity, to build more bigger motorways and add more lanes on. And what we know from painful experience is that induced demand simply means that those new lanes and new roads fill up with cars. What we know by contrast is that when you build modern, convenient, affordable and efficient public transport systems, many people choose to use them. And what that means is that it takes pressure off the roads because people move off the road. Some people leave their cars at home and take a transit bus or a train, for example, choose to do their emails or listen to music or drink coffee while they ride to work instead of sitting on the motorway. And what happens is that you get an equilibrium working, and the better your public transport works, the more people will choose to take it, leave their cars at home, and that does in fact allow the roads to move more freely. The opposite, of course, of that virtuous circle is a kind of a downward spiral. If your public transport is not efficient and not well set up, and journey times are long, people desert public transport and take the car, and that causes more and more congestion, and it means that people's journey times on the roads get longer and longer. So we have to break that cycle by investing in modern public transport systems. We also know that the challenges of reducing carbon emissions to meet our goal of carbon neutrality by 2050 means we are going to have to not only electrify the vehicle fleet, but get more people using public transport as we transition to electric transit systems. And the third reason, I think, is about quality of the urban environment and livability and placemaking. And we know that one of the terrible legacies of car-dependent cities have been cities that are unlivable. Cities where the best real estate is devoted to space for cars to drive and to be parked. and it ruins the scale and the intimacy of neighbourhoods and cityscapes. And we know that when you actually make people the priority, you get much better, more enjoyable and safer and healthier and more livable neighbourhoods and communities. So I think those are three pretty powerful arguments for reducing car dependency. I've recently asked our transport agency, NZTA, to local government in the six metro centres, including Christchurch, to bring together a lot of the work that we've got underway in our transport system to around the indicator of mode shift. And that indicator is how successful are we at encouraging people to leave behind single occupant vehicles and walk or cycle or take public transport to when they go to work or to education and all the other things that people are going to do. And so that's something that NZTA is going to be working on in your case with Environ Canterbury, putting out a mode shift plan for Canterbury that should bring together all of the investment in infrastructure and services, all of the current spending, future plans for spending, to work out how to maximise that mode shift. And that's a big difference. You know, in NZTA, our transport agency, they spend $3.5 billion a year of our taxes on the transport system. And mostly they've been an agency that's been concerned with building a whole lot of motorways and roads. And now we're asking them to still build motorways and roads occasionally, but we're asking them to work in partnership with local government to change human behaviour. Not just to spend $1 billion here or fund a project over there or build a new motorway, to make it their business to actually change human behaviour and drive that mode shift that we need to see. So one of the other sort of key bits of policy in this area is investing in rapid transit. And we understand rapid transit to be the essential backbone or spine of a modern public transport system. And in a city like Christchurch, you've got to provide that rapid transit spine from which the public transport services can hang off. And you need to be able to provide rapid transit or mass transit as a train or a bus that essentially doesn't have to compete with the traffic. So it needs to be in some way separated from the traffic. And you have a number of then interchanges off that rapid transit service for walking and cycling and for buses and mobility as a service to bring people to and from the stations. And the idea really is to build a network of rapid transit lines that give people access across the city to the things they need and the ability to travel from one side of the city to the other to get what they need. This kind of links back to the other thing I mentioned earlier, which was the need to better integrate transport thinking with housing and urban development. And when we invest in rapid transit systems, what we know is that they create really significant uplift in the quality or the amenity of the neighbourhoods around those rapid transit stations or interchanges. And if you apply a kind of a walking radius of 800 metres or 1,000 metres around those rapid transit stations, you essentially get a corridor of this high amenity where people want to live and investors want to invest. And it's an opportunity to encourage this, instead of the kind of auto-dependent spread of low-density suburbs, this is an opportunity to build more quality, intensified urban development around these transit corridors and interchanges. That intensification is important because in our modern expensive housing markets, urban intensification offers the possibility for the building of homes, of styles and typologies like apartments and flats and townhouses and terraces that have a smaller land footprint and are therefore more affordable. And that less space is often more than compensated for in the environment that's very attractive for people to live in. So those are some of the key themes of our transport and housing and urban development policies that I think offer hopefully some opportunities for the sort of thinking that you're doing about the future of Christchurch's built environment. I wanted to really kind of touch on one of the important policy developments that we've got underway. And that's the creation of a housing and urban development authority. The reason we're setting up this new organisation, a new central government agency to do housing and urban development, is that we've really struggled in New Zealand to not only to open up new areas for development and growth and urban growth, but particularly to undertake brown or grey fields development within existing cities. And the reason is that mostly we haven't had to in the past. Our cities have been sufficiently small that a kind of 1950s development model where the city just radiates out with low-rise suburban expansion on the fringes of the city, supported by roads and motorways. Now, the trouble is that our cities have got to a size where that becomes problematic because people don't necessarily want to commute an hour on the motorway to get to where the jobs are. And the imperatives of reducing carbon emissions mean that this kind of highly dispersed development is problematic as well. So the idea of the Housing and Urban Development Authority is a highly sort of tooled up public agency that can lead and facilitate large scale urban development projects. And it will have all of the tools that currently only local government has. It will have the ability to do RMA consenting. It'll have the ability within a defined project area or a precinct to amend and change district plans. It will have the ability to configure infrastructure, including roads, but the three waters as well, and reconfigure parks and reserves. It will be able to zone for height and density, and also it will have the ability to use new funding tools to raise money to pay for the infrastructure that's needed to support urban growth, including the ability to levy a rate. That's really important because one of the things that's been a big roadblock to urban growth and development in New Zealand is a lack of finance to invest in the infrastructure, roads and three waters and electricity and all the rest, to do large-scale urban development projects. And many of our councils don't have room on their balance sheet to just borrow more money and invest in that infrastructure. Alongside the Urban Development Authority, we're also making some changes at the moment, allowing long-term bond finance in urban infrastructure. And this means that, you know, people will have the opportunity to invest, either investors from New Zealand or overseas, to invest in this infrastructure. It will sit on a balance sheet that's not central government or the council. It's called a special purpose vehicle. And that debt will be serviced and paid off over the lifetime of the asset by a charge on the properties in that development, properties who benefit from this investment. So it's a new and alternative way of financing the infrastructure for large developments. And alongside the Housing and Urban Development Authority, it gives us two powerful new tools to really open up urban development at scale and at pace. Just to give you one example, or a couple of examples actually, of where we're looking at using these tools. You know, you'll be aware that in Auckland we're planning a rapid transit project with two new light rail lines that will go across different parts of the city. And our intention is to create an urban development project along these corridors. So thinking about that walking radius around each of the stations, put together they essentially create a corridor. The UDA, the Urban Development Authority, then kind of governs that area. It does the planning, the infrastructure, and tries to ensure that we get the best possible development outcomes, the kind of housing, and encourages private investment in building commercial or apartment blocks and so on and so forth. We're also doing it, we're quite far advanced with similar discussions in Wellington with both the Wellington City Council and the Greater Wellington Regional Council on a big package of transport investments. Multimodal, it will include some improvements to state highways, but lots of investment in walking and cycling and public transport and rapid transit. And we're talking, Wellington Council are very keen to set up a joint venture urban development authority around the rapid transit corridor that would allow them to get the best possible development of new housing and apartment blocks and investment that will take advantage of the big uplift in amenity caused by having that rapid transit network there. So finally, let me just say a couple of things about the sort of next steps in Canterbury, and I want to underline how much I appreciate the thinking and the debate that seems to be getting really underway. I think that the project in Canterbury really is to think through what an integrated housing and urban development and transport urban development strategy would look like for Canterbury. That touches on some of the things that I was raising before about sustainability, about reducing car dependency. So we've got rapid transit, public transport, and roads and motorways in an integrated transport network. Urban economy that produces the kinds of housing that people want at prices they can afford in places where they want to live. I think that's the challenge. I've had a couple of discussions with the Greater Canterbury Partnership, which you're probably familiar with. It's a kind of consortium of local government and business interests and other public agencies. And Ngāi Tahu in Canterbury, and they've got a pretty well established point to get on some of these things. I know that the Greater Canterbury urban development strategy is something that is kind of a live piece of work at the moment, and I look forward to Canterbury coming up with that, a really fantastic 21st century joined up plan for urban development that touches on the sort of challenges that I've been talking about and is an opportunity for central government and local government to work together on. So let me leave that there, and if you want me to take questions or respond to comments, whatever, I'm really happy to do that.
Okay, thanks, Phil. Glenn here, how are you? All right, we've had quite a few questions. I think we've got about 30 so far that have come through. What we might do is actually send to you the list of all the questions, and you might go into those sometime as well. But some that I guess are particularly relevant to what you've just been talking about. Firstly, there was an interesting one. Is there a place for a unitary transport authority for Christchurch, Greater Christchurch, in place of the current district, city and regional councils?
So anything's possible. I have to say that's something that I want to, that kind of idea would need to arise out of a conversation with people in Canterbury. It's not something that I would be keen to, be initiating or promoting from central government. I have had some discussions with the Mayor, Leon Dalzell, and Steve Lowndes from Environment Canterbury. There is some legislation, for example, that was inadvertently changed a couple of years ago under the last government, which closed off the possibility of the regional council delegating public transport functions to another local government entity. And we've agreed, at the request of Leanne and Steve, the next available opportunity, which I think will be quite soon, to reverse that back to what it was before, where councils would have the ability to delegate those responsibilities. But I haven't been part of any discussions about creating a unitary transport authority. So I have to say, in the experience in Auckland, which I'm because that's my hometown, I'm very familiar with benefits of creating Auckland Transport out of what was seven other local authorities. And the super city is by no means perfect, as Aucklanders will tell you. Creating a unified transport agency with scale and a level of professionalism and a strategic overview is certainly one of the big success stories of Auckland in recent years.
Excellent. Okay, another one. How can Christchurch best provide the business case required for a step change in public transport as has been done in Auckland?
So I think that I've sort of taking transport policy and housing policy into the political domain, the really essential thing to do here. And transport and housing are now two of the biggest, most intensely contested issues in our national politics. And they are incredibly important parts of local politics as well. And I think it's through the political process, through campaigning and public debates and developing policy and so on, and contesting elections, that's how you thrash out a political consensus about what needs to be done. And I've seen that happen in Auckland and also Wellington to some extent. And I think that that's the way to do it. And getting candidates to campaign on good is a really important thing to do. So I look at Canterbury and the quality of the urban development strategy pre-earthquakes was impressive. A lot of the work that was done after the quakes around the future of the participatory planning work that was done about that I think led to the blueprint was incredibly positive as well. And what's needed now is this kind of a really modern, fully joined up, really switched on urban plan for post-recovery Canterbury. That's what's needed. And I think transport's at the heart of it.
Okay. There's a question, I think, sort of touching about the interaction between the Urban Development Authority and the local authorities there. And basically the question is whether a HUD would be micromanaging what local councils would do, and is the better alternative to simply give better tools for councils to do it themselves?
Yeah, so I think I might have made this comment earlier when I was talking in that, is that we're very consciously central government into the urban development space, because in many places the policy settings that we've had simply haven't been working, and when cities fail, you get, for example, incredibly expensive housing or terrible traffic gridlock. It's basically central government that picks up the tab. So I think central government's got a responsibility to be fully engaged and in there with the Urban Development Authority. What we're planning to do is to build an organisation that's got a lot of strength and capability at central government level and technical expertise and so on, and access to the powers that we're going to legislate. But at the local level, there will be a project team and a governance board at the local level that will run the project locally. And we're setting that up so that it can be a joint venture vehicle. And so in many parts of the country, we're talking with councils about how central government and local government will partner together through the Urban Development Authority on specific projects. The other thing, though, is that I'm very interested in whether or not and whether we can basically allow councils to use the urban development powers and structure, so that central government, you know, there may be some cases where central government doesn't have the bandwidth to do, you know, more than a certain number of projects, but a council might say, you know what, we'd really like to be able to use the powers and the structure of the Urban Development Authority to take on this, you know, an urban regeneration of a particular part of our city. Well, why not? Why not do that?
Okay. You talked a little bit previously about, I guess, how it would be funded through value uplift and investments and things like that. Who should underwrite the risk between transport investment and value uplift? And this is particularly important when much of the housing stock is so new that it's unlikely to be redeveloped sustainably for decades.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, the government and central government and local government have to be willing, on behalf of their taxpayers and ratepayers, to invest in growth. One of the problems that we've had is, in New Zealand, is that incumbent ratepayers, homeowners in the leafy suburbs, for example, put so much political pressure on their elected representatives at local government not to put the rates up, that council doesn't then have the balance sheet to be able to invest in the growth of the city. So that's basically protecting the position of incumbents and disadvantaging millennials, aspiring homeowners who want to have affordable housing. And that's part of the political economy of our cities that we have to challenge. Got to be more pro-growth, because it's about looking after people who need housing and they need affordable housing. So that, I think that's part of the answer. The other is that I think we've also got to be more creative about finding new ways to fund and finance the growth of our cities. And so we've got to be, you know, we've funded our transport system out of what's called a pay-go system. Even quite big investments in roading projects, for example, are typically funded out of the current year's tax take. This is crazy, because this is infrastructure investment, the lifetime of 100 years. We should be spreading the cost of that investment over the generations of people who will benefit from it. So we need to be more innovative in that way. We should be using tools like value capture. You know, this is something that cities all over the world are grappling with right now. Let's say you invest a couple of billion dollars in some rapid transit infrastructure. It will inevitably have the effect creating massive windfall gains for incumbent property owners who happen to own land, you know, around the corridor or the interchange. It's the same with roads and motorways. They have exactly the same effect. They create a massive uplift in the property values because of increased connectivity. So what we've got to learn to do is capture some of that value. Now, is to be not too greedy. You try and tax it too heavily, you end up deterring the very development that you want to encourage. But there's no reason a small share of that uplift can't be captured through rates or a tax and then reinvested in the infrastructure on behalf of the public. So I think all of those things are sort of challenges for us.
We're almost out of time for here. I guess I want to wrap up with one more question. We've heard comment about Labor's pre-election promise for Canterbury was investing in rail. They took about $100 million towards rail or rapid transit. And I know some people have said, where's the money? So I wonder if you could just reiterate for the audience here, your thinking of what happens now.
Where's the money? I love them.
I'm waiting for a really good proposal from your elected leaders.
Simple as that.
Okay.
Thank you, Minister, for your time. We've lost your sound for some reason.
Let me finish that sentence.
Okay. Yep.
This proposal's got to be part of a joined up and credible transport and housing and urban growth plan. It's got to be supported by all of your elected leaders, and it's got to be prioritised through your regional land transport plan. But I would like nothing better than to talk to you about what this plan would look like for Canterbury and how central government can work with your local government leadership to achieve it.
Thanks
very much for having me, and I hope the rest of the evening goes well.
Thank you.
Thank you.